Vancouver, Tuesday, June 8th, 4:55 p.m. Nat Damon signed the paper with a flourish.
I've never been asked to sign a non-disclosure agreement before.
I'm surprised, the man in the shiny suit said, taking the paper back. I would have thought it was standard procedure. We don't want our proprietary information to get discussed. He was a lawyer accompanying his client, a bearded man with glasses, wearing jeans and a work shirt. This bearded man said he was a petroleum geologist, and Damon believed him. He certainly looked like the other petroleum geologists he had dealt with. Damon's company was called Canada Marine RS Technologies. From a tiny, cramped office outside Vancouver, Damon leased research submarines and remote submersibles to clients around the world. Damon didn't own these subs, he just leased them. The subs were located all over the world, in Yokohama, Dubai, Melbourne, San Diego. They ranged from fully operational 50-foot submersibles with crews of six capable of traveling around the globe, to tiny one-man diving machines, and even smaller remote robotic vehicles that operated from a tender ship on the surface. Damon's clients were energy and mining companies who used the subs for undersea prospecting or to check the condition of offshore rigs and platforms. His was a specialized business, and his little office at the back of a boat repair yard did not receive many visitors. Yet these two men had come through his door just before closing time. The lawyer had done all of the talking. The client merely gave Damon a business card that said Seismic Services with a Calgary address. That made sense. Calgary was a big city for hydrocarbon companies. Petro-Canada, Shell, and Suncor were all there, and many more. And dozens of small private consulting firms had sprung up there to do prospecting and research. Damon took a small model down from the shelf behind him. It was a tiny, white, snub-nosed submarine with a bubble top. He set it on the table in front of the men.
"This is the vehicle I would recommend for your needs," he said. "The RS Scorpion, built in England just 4 years ago. Two-man crew, diesel and electric power with closed-cycle argon drive. Submerged, it runs on 20% oxygen, 80% argon. Solid, proven technology, potassium hydroxide scrubber, 200-volt electrical, operational depth of 2,000 feet, and 3.8 hours dive time. It's the equivalent of the Japanese Shinkai 2000, if you know that one, or the Downstar 80, of which there are four in the world, but they're all on long leases. The Scorpion is an excellent submarine."
The men nodded and looked at each other.
"And what kind of external manipulators are there?" the bearded man said.
"Well, that's depth-dependent," Damon said. "At lesser depths, let's say at 2,000 feet, what external manipulators are there?"
"You want to collect samples at 2,000 feet?"
"Actually, we're placing monitoring devices on the bottom."
"I see. Like radio devices sending data to the surface?"
"Something like that."
"How large are these devices?"
The bearded man held his hands 2 feet apart.
"About so big."
"And they weigh what?"
"Oh, I don't know exactly, maybe 200 pounds.
Damon concealed his surprise. Usually petroleum geologists knew precisely what they were going to place. Exact dimensions, exact weight, exact specific gravity, all that. This guy was vague, but perhaps Damon was just being paranoid. He continued,
"And these sensors are for geological work?"
"Ultimately. First, we need information on ocean currents, flow rates, bottom temperatures, that kind of thing."
Damon thought, for what? Why did they need to know about currents? Of course, they might be sinking a tower, but nobody would do that in 2,000 feet of water. What were these guys intending to do?
"Well," he said,
If you want to place external devices, you have to secure them to the exterior of the hull prior to the dive. There are lateral shelves on each side. He pointed to the model. For that purpose, once you're at depth, you have a choice of two remote arms to place the devices. How many devices are you talking about?
Quite a few.
More than eight?
Oh, yes, probably.
Well, then you're talking about multiple dives. You can only take 8, maybe 10 external devices on any given dive.
He talked on for a while, scanning their faces, trying to understand what lay behind the bland looks. They wanted to lease the sub for 4 months, starting in August of that year. They wanted the sub and the tender ship transported to Port Moresby, New Guinea. They would pick it up there.
Depending on where you go, there are some required marine licenses.
We'll worry about that later, the lawyer said.
Now, the crew.
We'll worry about that later, too.
It's part of the contract.
Then just write it in, however you do it.
You'll return the tender to Moresby at the end of the lease period?
Yes.
Damon sat down in front of the desktop computer and began to fill in the estimate forms. There were, all in all, 43 categories, not including insurance, that had to be filled out. At last, he had the final number.
$583,000, he said.
The men didn't blink. They just nodded.
Half in advance.
They nodded again.
Second half in escrow account prior to your taking delivery in Port Moresby.
He never required that with his regular customers, but for some reason, these two made him uneasy.
That will be fine, the lawyer said.
Plus 20% contingency, payable in advance.
That was simply unnecessary, but now he was trying to make these guys go away. It didn't work.
That will be fine.
Okay, Damon said. Now, if you need to talk to your contracting company before you sign,
no, we're prepared to proceed now.
And then one of them pulled out an envelope and handed it to Damon.
Tell me if this is satisfactory.
It was a check for $250,000 from Seismic Services, payable to Canada Marine. Damon nodded and said it was. He put the check and the envelope on his desk, next to the submarine model. Then one of the men said,
"Do you mind if I make a couple of notes?"
And picked up the envelope and scribbled on it. And it was only after they were gone that Damon realized they had given him the check and taken back the envelope, so there would be no fingerprints. Or was he just being paranoid? The following morning, he was inclined to think so. When he went to Scotiabank to deposit the check, he stopped by to see John Kim, the bank manager, and asked him to find out if there were sufficient funds in the Seismic Services account to cover the check. John Kim said he would check right away. Stung Fedless, Monday, August 23rd, 3:02 a.m. Christ, it was cold, George Morton thought, climbing out of the Land Cruiser. The millionaire philanthropist stamped his feet and pulled on gloves, trying to warm himself. It was 3 o'clock in the morning, and the sky glowed red, with streaks of yellow from the still visible sun. A bitter wind blew across the Springasunder, the rugged, dark plain in the interior of Iceland. Flat gray clouds hung low over the lava that stretched away for miles. The Icelanders loved this place. Morton couldn't see why. In any case, they had reached their destination. Directly ahead lay a huge, crumpled wall of dirt-covered snow and rock, stretching up to the mountains behind. This was Skeiðarárjökull, one tongue of the huge Vatnajökull glacier, the largest ice cap in Europe. The driver, a graduate student, climbed out and clapped his hands with delight.
"Not bad at all. Quite warm. You are lucky. It's a pleasant August night."
He was wearing a T-shirt, hiking shorts, and a light vest. Morton was wearing a down vest, a quilted windbreaker, and heavy pants. And he was still cold. He looked back as the others got out of the back seat. Nicholas Drake, thin and frowning, wearing a shirt and tie and a tweed sport coat beneath his windbreaker, winced as the cold air hit him. With his thinning hair, wire-frimmed glasses, and pinched, disapproving manner, Drake conveyed a scholarly quality that, in fact, he cultivated. He did not want to be taken for what he was, a highly successful litigator who had retired to become the director of the National Environmental Resource Fund, a major American activist group. He had held the job at NERF for the last 10 years. Next, young Peter Evans bounced out of the car. Evans was the youngest of Morton's attorneys, and the one he liked best. Evans was 28 and a junior associate of the Los Angeles firm of Hassell and Black. Now, even late at night, he remained cheerful and enthusiastic. He pulled on a Patagonia fleece and stuck his hands in his pockets, but otherwise gave no sign that the weather bothered him. Morton had flown all of them in from Los Angeles on his Gulfstream G5 jet, arriving in Keflavik Airport at 9 yesterday morning. None of them had slept, but nobody was tired, not even Morton, and he was 65 years old. He didn't feel the slightest sense of fatigue, just cold. Morton zipped up his jacket and followed the graduate student down the rocky hill from the car.
"The light at night gives you energy," the kid said. "Dr. Einarsson never sleeps more than 4 hours a night in the summer. None of us does."
"And where is Dr. Einarsson?" Morton asked.
"Down there," the kid pointed off to the left.
At first, Morton could see nothing at all. Finally, he saw a red dot and realized it was a vehicle. That was when he grasped the enormous size of the glacier. Drake fell into step with Morton as they went down the hill.
"George," he said, "you and Evans should feel free to go on a tour of the site, and let me talk to Per Einarsson alone."
"Why?"
"I expect Einarsson will be more comfortable if there weren't a lot of people standing around."
"But isn't the point that I'm the one who funds his research?"
"Of course," Drake said. "But I don't want to hammer that fact too hard. I don't want Pear to feel compromised."
"I don't see how you can avoid it."
"I'll just point out the stakes," Drake said. "Help him see the big picture."
"Frankly, I was looking forward to hearing this discussion," Morton said.
"I know," Drake said. "But it's delicate."
As they came closer to the glacier, Morton felt a distinct chill in the wind. The temperature dropped several degrees. They could see now the series of 4 large tan tents arranged near the red Land Cruiser. From a distance, the tents had blended into the plain. From one of the tents, a very tall, blond man appeared. Per Einarsson threw up his hands and shouted,
"Nicholas!"
"Per!" Drake raced forward. Morton continued down the hill, feeling distinctly grouchy about being dismissed by Drake. Evans came up to walk alongside him.
"I don't want to take any damn tour," Morton said.
"Oh, I don't know," Evans said, looking ahead. "It might be more interesting than we think."
Coming out of one of the other tents were 3 young women in khakis, all blonde and beautiful. They waved to the newcomers.
"Maybe you're right," Morton said.